From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. As traumatic as last week's big quakes were to the Ridgecrest area, damage could have been much worse. The lower magnitude Northridge earthquake of 1994 caused far more extensive damage and loss of life. Much of that was due to more people living near the epicenter, but there was another big difference, which we'll explore right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Pleasure to have you with us. The head of the California Earthquake Authority will answer your questions about quake insurance. Does it make sense for you as a homeowner or a renter to buy earthquake insurance? We'll hear the pros and cons. Well, on the 4th of July, a 6.4 magnitude quake occurred near Ridgecrest in the Mojave Desert. The following night, Friday, July 5th, a 7.1 magnitude quake hit near the first. Turned out the Independence Day shake was a foreshock of Friday's. As traumatic as the quake was for Ridgecrest area residents, there was relatively limited damage for such a big one. Obviously, a big part of that was the limited population near the epicenter. But there's more to it. The complexity of earthquakes, very great. And with us, research professor of geophysics and director of the Caltech Seismological Laboratory, Ale Hawkson. Ale, good to have you with us again on Air Talk. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, let's talk about how intensity of shaking is a different thing than the magnitude of an earthquake according to the Richter scale, because I think for many of us, we assume that if a quake is of the same magnitude of another, that they will be shaking the same.
So a magnitude is a property of the earthquake, no matter where the observer is. It's simply describing how much energy is released, or in other words, the size of the earthquake. So it's always the same no matter where you are, if you're near the earthquake or on the other side of the earth. Intensity of shaking describes how you feel shaking or experience shaking at the location where you're at.
And how much does the soil factor into that? For example, the Northridge earthquake, much lower magnitude than the 7.1 last Friday night in Ridgecrest. But the ground shaking in the Northridge area as well as other parts of the L.A. Basin was extreme.
Yes, it was quite strong because the movement in the Northridge earthquake on the fault plane was very sharp. So it caused very strong ground shaking in the San Fernando Valley and all the way up through Santa Clarita. In this quake, the movement on the fault plane was not very sharp, so the strong ground shaking was spread over a much smaller area, though it was spread over an area of about 30 miles long and about 5 to 10 miles wide.
And Ale, what about the depth of an earthquake? So if you have a 7.1 magnitude quake that's comparatively shallow, you have another one that's comparatively deeper, and let's say the composition of the soil is similar, is that greater depth going to lead to less intense shaking?
So the greater depth can lead to less intense shaking in the immediate epicentral area. But then again, very strong to severe shaking can be spread over a much larger area if the event is deep. If the event is shallow, you expect very intense shaking right on top of the epicenter and the fault line, but you don't expect very severe shaking further away.
If you have questions for Ale Hawkson, who is research professor of geophysics at Caltech, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. We're talking about how the magnitude of an earthquake on the Richter scale doesn't necessarily give a sense of the intensity of the ground shaking or of its potential for damage. As we know, Ridgecrest, an area that's nowhere near as populated as metropolitan Los Angeles, that helped to limit the damage, although, of course, there were structures destroyed by fires and by damage caused by the earthquake. We now have a report of a fatality linked to last Thursday's 6.4 magnitude quake in Pahrump, Nevada. Authorities there say a man who was working under his car apparently was killed when the shaking from that earthquake last Thursday caused the car to fall off of the jack, and he was killed as a result. 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Al, what about the structures in the Ridgecrest and Trona area? How did they seem to perform versus the size of this quake?
They seemed to perform quite well because most of them were built after World War II. So they were built according to more modern building codes. And they didn't have any unreinforced masonry buildings. So all in all, Ridgecrest did fairly well. And that shows the success of earthquake engineering in the state of California.
Well, have we heard about the China Lake Naval Weapons Station where the Friday night quake was reported to have broken the surface there? Have we gotten reports back on what was found there on that base?
Yeah, a significant amount of surface rupture, as we call it, or a very long scarp that extended for about 20 miles was discovered on the base and was studied by geologists. They measured the offset on the scarp to get an idea of the movement on the fault in this particular earthquake. Those geological features are very prominent and are going to provide very important data for future understanding of earthquakes and earthquake hazards.
So what are some of the things that can potentially be learned by measurements of the surface rupture?
For instance, we can correlate that with the measured ground shaking and understand how movement on the fault that we can actually observe at the surface affects the ground shaking. Also, we can understand how, if we build buildings near a fault line, how those might be affected or damaged by movement on the fault. In this case, the fault zone itself that moved is fairly wide, wider than what we often see in other areas of the state.
What, for you, the most significant thing to think about when it comes to the intensity of the shaking, and particularly of the kinds of soils that people's structures are on? How significant is that to what people are going to experience from an earthquake?
It's very important, especially if it's water-saturated soil. It can amplify the shaking and cause a significant amount of damage if buildings are built on very soft soil. But again, we have to remember that even though this was 7.1, it's not that big an earthquake. We're expecting a magnitude 7.8 or possibly 8 on a San Andreas. And then instead of here, you had strong ground shaking extended for 30 miles. Then you would have strong ground shaking extending maybe for 100 to 150 miles.
And in the metropolitan L.A. area, there's a lot of structures that are on loosely compacted soils. So that's something to keep in mind. I mean, much of the San Fernando Valley and San Gabriel Valleys, places like Marina del Rey, you've got a lot of places that are built on anything but bedrock.
Yes.
Al, you there? I think we lost our connection with him. We're talking with Al Hawkson, who is research professor of geophysics at Caltech in Pasadena. You'll often hear him on the news conferences talking about the importance of quake preparation, what's being learned about particular earthquakes as well. We're talking now several days after the pair of quakes which hit in the Ridgecrest area on Thursday, July 4th, the 10:33 a.m. quake, 6.4 magnitude, which we now know was a foreshock to Friday night's 7.1 earthquake that hit the Ridgecrest area. The number of residents who at that point, because of the swarm of aftershocks, were uncomfortable about going back into their homes. Very traumatic experience for residents there, but comparatively little damage. Now, Trona, which is an older town, hit harder in many ways than Ridgecrest, as the construction there older the buildings than what was found in Ridgecrest. Al, we lost you there just a moment. The point I was making is that in metropolitan L.A., just, you know, much of this, because of the mountains which ring the basin, much of the construction is on alluvial fan, the runoff from those mountains.
That is correct. So you there are many types of effects that will influence the shaking of buildings and structures in the area, including liquefaction. There will also be reverberation of the waves at the edges of the basin, where sometimes you get constructive interference and the waves are amplified. Also, waves tend to bounce back and forth in a basin like in a bowl of jello, and that causes extended duration of shaking.
In the case of Northridge, that one was very close in. We had a lot of damage. If the San Andreas ruptures, and I know it depends on which part of the fault would slip, but if it's much farther away than Northridge, would the quake likely last longer? And as a result, could it be even more damaging, not just because of the magnitude of the quake, but because of the length of time the shaking would occur?
Yeah, that is certainly the case. Northridge, it took only about 7 seconds to break the fault. In a major earthquake on a San Andreas, it may take 1 to 2 minutes to break the fault, so that will be the duration of extremely strong shaking, and that shaking will radiate into the Los Angeles Basin and make buildings and structures go through many cycles of violent shaking and hence be much more likely to be damaged.
All right. Al, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much. That's Al Hawkson, research professor of geophysics at Caltech, and we remind you our multi-part podcast, The Big One, is available from Apple Podcasts, any place that you'd like to get your podcasts, and of course at kpcc.org and las.org. We'll continue by talking about earthquake insurance. For whom does it make sense? For whom not? With us will be the head of the California Earthquake Authority, Glenn Pomeroy, back in 1 minute. Over the past several days, I've had a number of friends or family members bring up the issue of earthquake insurance and whether it financially makes sense. It can be quite expensive. There's a big deductible. People wonder if there's going to be so much emergency aid available in the event of a massive earthquake that quake insurance wouldn't necessarily be needed. But we're going to ask the man who heads the California Earthquake Authority what he thinks about whether it makes sense for Californians in certain circumstances to buy earthquake insurance. Glenn Pomeroy, CEO of the California Earthquake Authority. Glenn, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you.
Has your phone been proverbially ringing off the hook the past few days?
Proverbially glued to my ear. It's been busy for obvious reasons. I mean, we just got the Waco call, and you know, people have heard it.
So let's talk about the cost of earthquake insurance, because that's perhaps the biggest impediment to people buying it, is the perception that it's like paying for homeowners insurance a whole other time, doubling what you're paying to protect your home. What's been the change in the cost of earthquake insurance over the past couple of years?
Well, really over the past 20 years or so, after the Northridge earthquake, the landscape changed for earthquake insurance in California, because that 25 years ago, after that event, private for-profit companies, for the most part, didn't want to have anything to do with earthquake risk anymore. So they quit writing homeowners insurance even to get out from under having to offer earthquake insurance. So that's when the state formed this California Earthquake Authority. We're a nonprofit insurance company. We're not a state agency. We're a nonprofit insurance company. We're governed by the governor, insurance commissioner, state treasurer. That's the board that I report to. But we are a not-for-profit insurance company, and what we've been doing for the last couple of decades is lowering rates. They soared after Northridge, but we brought them down. We've lowered rates by over 50% since we've been around, and we've now got a whole bunch of coverage options. And so, long story short, Larry, is we've made a lot of progress making earthquake insurance way more affordable than it would have been had the state not taken that action 20 years ago.
One of the concerns I hear from people is, well, if you have a massive earthquake in California in an urban area, that the payouts would be so high to cover the CEA policies that the CEA wouldn't be able to fulfill its full obligations, and people would get just, you know, percentages of what they would be entitled to. Can you respond to that concern?
Yeah, it's extremely, extremely unlikely that an earthquake will occur that will cause that to happen. It would take an earthquake far bigger than one California has ever experienced ever in history. But specifically what I mean is we have today $17 billion at the ready to handle whatever earthquake we're gonna be hit with. That's enough for what's called a 1 in 400 year event. Or in other words, there's only a 1 in 400 chance, 1 in 400 chance that an earthquake will exceed the amount of money we have to pay claims. So, and if that happens, in the unlikely event that happens, and let's say we have 90% enough, well, then people are going to get paid 90 cents on the dollar, but every single one of those who are insured are going to be able to recover and survive, as opposed to everybody else who's uninsured. And it's extremely unlikely that we're ever going to have to be in that pro rata situation. So it's a common myth, and I'm glad you asked, but people shouldn't worry about that. The thing is, we got plenty of money to pay claims. People who aren't insured are certainly going to be entirely on their own.
I want to follow up with that in a moment, but first, this is your opportunity to ask any question you have about earthquake insurance with Glenn Pomeroy, the CEO of the California Earthquake Authority. 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. If you have any questions about coverage, the premiums, the deductibles, the fund created to pay out in the event of an earthquake, when it makes sense for someone based in, you know, their status with a mortgage to have homeowners, 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Now, Glenn, you mentioned that people with earthquake insurance are going to be far ahead of those who don't have it in the event of a quake, but I think there are many people who forego the insurance who have the view, well, if anything's that big an event, the feds are going to step in with FEMA money. They're not going to allow hundreds of thousands of people to be homeless. Federal money will be there for people to repair or rebuild. Your response?
Yeah, and another misconception, and really a dangerous one, but it's not uncommon for that thought to be out there. Fact of the matter is, fortunately, we do have a federal government that does respond to emergencies. FEMA, a disaster relief agency, rushes to the front lines and in the days following the event, you know, sets up card tables and receives applicants. And if there's a presidential declaration declared, FEMA can ultimately get into the position of providing some emergency assistance relief. They can actually provide grants if someone's eligible, of up to, say, $33,000, but that's it. That's the max. No more, and that money can't be used to rebuild homes. So, for people who have seen the footage of and have heard about FEMA grants, and they somehow translate that into thinking that FEMA is going to rebuild their home, they're living on false hope, and it concerns me, because I don't want people thinking they're financially protected when they're not. I think it's much better for them to realize FEMA's federal assistance is limited. Earthquake insurance is completely excluded from their homeowner's policy. They are absolutely going to be financially on their own if they don't have an earthquake insurance policy. If they lose their home, they're going to have to figure out what happens next. I talk to people who tell me their life changed after Northridge when they didn't have an earthquake insurance policy and they lost most of their life savings that was tied up in the equity of their home. While FEMA came in and helped rebuild chimneys and did some stuff back then, it didn't rebuild people's homes. And the harsh reality hits following the event.
Jennifer in Northridge, good to have you with us. Your question for the CEO of the California Earthquake Authority, Glenn Pomeroy.
Mr. Pomeroy, just answer my question. I just bought a single-family home in April in Northridge, and I asked about earthquake insurance from the developer, and this gentleman told me, don't worry about it. FEMA will cover you. So I'm very grateful. I'll be relooking into that policy.
All right, Jennifer, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Rob in Sherman Oaks, welcome.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, Larry. My question is the California Earthquake Authority reinsured? Have they purchased insurance to cover themselves in the event of a loss that is above and beyond what they can pay out? And then the follow-up is, if not, why not?
Glenn Pomeroy.
Very astute question. Yeah, we have a ton of reinsurance. We have about $6 billion in the bank, but we buy a ton of reinsurance to get up to that $17 billion in claims paying capacity. It pains me to do it every year. We're going to spend about $400 million this year on our reinsurance protection. We spent about that much last year. And the year before, we have spent $5 billion on reinsurance since we were formed 20-some years ago, and when we received back $250,000 in reinsurance recoveries. But we've had that insurance coverage in place for the big, unlikely, infrequent event, and it didn't happen, so that money just was paid out, and now we're going to do it again, if you follow me. Reinsurance basically is just insurance for insurance companies. And so we buy protection for a massive event, and the year passes and that massive event didn't occur, and we do the same thing the year following.
BB Steve writes on the page, the federal government offers low interest loans for catastrophic incidents, not funds to rebuild. Ask any fire or flood victims about that. So BB Steve's point is that people will be able to take out the low interest federal government loans to rebuild or repair their homes.
Good point. There, HUD does make low-interest loans available if someone's eligible, and again, if a presidential declaration is declared. But my understanding is there's a cap on how much loan is available, too. I think it's $200,000. And actually, let me just say, I think that's the case. I could be wrong, but I think the maximum HUD loan is $200,000. But that's just a loan. So assume you've got a mortgage. That's going to have to continue.
Which you'd still be responsible for unless you just walk away from the whole property.
Well, that's true. If you want to just throw in the keys and take a hit to your credit rating and walk away, that you could do that. That's not sound financial planning, in my opinion. And if you continue to pay your mortgage and you suddenly now have an additional mortgage, essentially in the form of a $200,000 loan to repay, again, I think there's. Look, what one should do before planning on relying on all of that, I think they should just take a look at how much earthquake insurance costs today, because it's so much more affordable than it used to be. I ran an estimate, Larry, before jumping on this line, of how much a policy would cost, and I took a zip code in Burbank. And the average reconstruction cost, and that's what we insure the home for, is its reconstruction value, not its market value. The average reconstruction cost in Burbank is $410,000. So I looked at a hypothetical 1990 home on a single-story home with a 15% deductible, which is kind of in the middle of the you can buy a 5% up to 25% deductible, but let's just say 15%, $600 a year, $636 actually, that policy would cost. You can choose a lower deductible and pay more for the increased coverage, or you can choose a lower deductible and pay less because you're getting less coverage. But that's the ballpark for that tip for that home. A policy would cost more if that home was an older home, built two-story, maybe built on a raised foundation. There, the 50% deductible was about $1,300 a year. You can raise or lower that depending on the deductible. And you can lower the premium by getting your home retrofitted. We've got a 25% discount now available for people who retrofit their older homes.
I wanted to also bring up the point that in the event of a major earthquake and significant damage throughout the region, it would probably be more than the current cost for reconstruction or repairs, because you're still going to have a limited labor pool to be able to carry out that work with huge customer demand because of all the damage.
Yeah, good point. It's called demand surge, and it's a problem when there's a massive disaster, like we actually have seen and played out in wildfire country, when you have hundreds of or perhaps thousands of homes destroyed. The price of reconstruction does go up because labor and materials becomes more difficult to obtain, and that hasn't all been calculated in the reconstruction value that was set the day that insurance policy was set. That's true. That's a problem. Basically, here in California, as we continue to deal with natural catastrophes, I think there's a lot of work underway to try to figure out how we deal with that problem to allow for there to be some more coverage built in anticipation of costs soaring after a disaster.
Sean in Redondo Beach, you're on Air Talk with Glenn Pomeroy, who heads the California Earthquake Authority.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. I think he mentioned it. I didn't in the past when I've owned a home, it was a set deductible, but if I'm hearing him right, it's like any other insurance vehicle you can choose. So obviously, the lower deductible you take, the bigger the premium. So what is the highest deductible that you can take to get that premium down?
Glenn?
25%. It used to be one size fits all. It used to be 15%. After Northridge, basically all deductibles were 15%, and premiums soared. But again, because we have this public mission, meaning I think it was 2016, the CEA rolled out deductibles ranging from 5% to 25% in increments of 5. So 5, 10, 15, 20, 25% are the selections you can make. And if you go to the premium calculator on our website, you'll get to basically a page that has these dials. You just dial that deductible where you want it, and you can see as you move from 15% to 5% deductible, you can see how the premium adjusts and goes up. But then you can slide that over to 25%, and you watch that premium go down. And you make choices with other coverage options available, how much personal property you want, how much additional living expense coverage you want. And as you make a change in the amount of coverage you're getting, you can see how it impacts the premium. So people in California can find the policy that meets their own needs and budget. They just have to spend a couple minutes going to our premium calculator and dialing it up the way they want it, and then call our agent and tell them they want to get insured.
Sean, appreciate the call. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Glenn, we are inundated with calls with questions, and I know we were letting you go in a couple minutes. Is there any chance you can stay longer with us and take more of these calls?
Absolutely, Larry. These are great questions.
Okay. I'm sorry to jam you up on your schedule at the last minute, but we didn't anticipate the volume we've got. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Tim in Palm Desert, good to have you with us. Your question for Glenn Pomeroy.
Yes. Just as a point of reference, I lost my home in a Loma Prieta earthquake.
Oh, sorry.
And I discovered that the insurance companies could not be held accountable for understanding the change in cost of construction, and also then notifying me that I should modify my insurance policy to account for the change in cost to replace my home.
So you're talking about things like changes in the code and stuff like that made it more expensive to rebuild?
I mean, just the cost per square foot. I lost $700,000 as a result. So who can insurance companies be held accountable for understanding the change in the base cost of replacement of your property?
Tim, appreciate the call. Glenn Pomeroy.
Yeah, very important point. The insurance company that insures a homeowner, the gentleman who lost his home in Loma Prieta, the insurance company really is supposed to periodically, or if not every year, make a recalculation in terms of what the reconstruction value of that home is supposed to be, because costs keep going up and up. So periodically, the reconstruction value of the home should go up. That'll increase the price of the homeowner's insurance, but they're getting more coverage to handle it in case their home's destroyed. That when that home then wishes to buy a separate earthquake insurance policy, if the homeowner insurance company is a member of ours, they can buy a CA policy. And how we determine the replacement value is we just take the value that the insurance company assigned. That's the only number that we have to use to know what to insure with. So I think he raises an important point. And I know the insurance commissioner is also concerned about this issue in general, as we've seen instances following wildfires, for example, where people have been hit by the problem that the gentleman was hit with, that after a disaster, it turns out there wasn't enough insurance coverage because the value of the policy didn't keep up with inflation.
But many of those policies do have that now, that full replacement as a part of a policy specifically. Tim, I appreciate your call. We'll continue with the CEO of the California Earthquake Authority taking your calls. Chance for you to talk with the head man at the CEA, Glenn Pomeroy, back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We have a special live program coming up a week from Friday right here at KPCC in our Crawford Family Forum. I'm going to be leading a conversation on the 50th anniversary of the human walk on the moon. We'll talk about that extraordinary journey, the whole technology that was developed here in Southern California, the aerospace industry, all the work that was done for NASA right here in Southern California. And we invite you to come join us. That's coming up 1 week from Friday in our Crawford Family Forum, July 19th, our 10 o'clock hour. It's free, but we ask you make a reservation by visiting kpcc.org/in-person. I hope to see you there. It's going to be a dynamite panel of people with expertise on the space race and talk about the landing on the moon. That's coming up. Right now, we're talking with Glenn Pomeroy, CEO of the California Earthquake Authority, who very graciously has agreed to stay with us as we have so many excellent listener questions about the pros and cons of buying earthquake insurance. Virginia in Newport Beach, welcome.
Thank you. You mentioned that prices have come down post-Northridge considerably thanks to the California Earthquake Authority. We added earthquake insurance through our homeowners private company we've been very happy with. And I wonder if we were foolish that whether the rates have also come down for private insurance companies.
Thanks, Virginia. Glenn?
You know, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, and that allows me to say, there are companies who operate outside of the CEA. Companies can join our organization, and then when they sell earthquake policy, they're selling our policy. But there are a number of companies that operate outside, and we sell about 80% of the policies. They split up the remaining 20%, but we don't consider them competitors because our public mission is to try to encourage Californians to get protected, whether through us or through them. I don't really know what their pricing structure is. You can jump on our website and see how it compares, but you wouldn't be able to buy a policy from us unless you have your underlying homeowner's insurance through one of our member companies.
Yeah, I was I had my homeowner's insurance with another company in the past, and so they didn't deal with the California Earthquake Authority, so I had to buy my earthquake insurance through a private company. Now I'm back with CEA because I switched homeowner's insurance. Virginia, thanks. Probably the best thing to do is just to compare the premiums, the deductibles, and just to get a sense of which is the better deal. But as Glenn just said, it is dependent on the company with whom you have your homeowner's insurance. 866-893-KPECC. Glenn, what percentage of the homeowner's insurance companies? Is it also about 80% that you work with?
Yeah, just about the companies that participate with us write about 75 to 80% of the homeowners' policies in California.
Okay, Rose in Northridge, good to have you with us.
Thank you. I have a quick question. We lived here. I moved in 93 with my husband and two children, and we were renters. We got an earthquake insurance policy. Their water heater at the time was strapped in the garage, and it came loose. We were in Granada Hills, and there was huge damage. The water heater damage to the things in the garage, our insurance company argued with us that it was a flood that caused it. It was not the earthquake. And we eventually, after a lot of hassle, won, and they resolved that claim. Now we're homeowners in Northridge, and we have earthquake insurance. But I'm wondering now with our pool, I know there's new policies about water heaters, strappings, et cetera. But what is my policy really going to cover if I have some kind of water damage?
That's a great question, Rose. Thanks. Glenn Pomeroy?
Yeah, our policy does not cover swimming pools, but it will cover water damage inside the house if the shake damage is busted pipes or busted the water heater and resulting water damage as a result. So basically, if a levee breaks and a flood comes in, that's flood coverage. But if something inside the house breaks, resulting in water damage as a result of the shaking that caused that breakage, that's covered by our policy.
All right. Rose, thanks very much. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Erin in Reseda, welcome.
Yes, I'm wondering, does it cover periphery walls? I had earthquake insurance. I was only 10 miles from the epicenter. It was through then 20th Century that dropped up, but they wouldn't cover it because they said they're mutually owned. So they would not cover the damage to the walls, periphery walls. Does California earthquake insurance cover that?
Glenn?
Forgive me, I'm not sure what you mean by...
I think she's talking about walls that separate neighboring properties. In the Northridge earthquake in the valley, you know, there are many of these cinder block walls that collapsed from that earthquake. And so it sounds like Aaron's saying that the homeowner's insurance, that they wouldn't pay on it because they said, well, those are common walls. They're not just yours. We're not going to pay for that.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to answer this one because I don't really know the answer. We cover single family homes or a structure that accommodates up to four families in one structure, and we'll insure that structure. We also insure like condominiums, for example, but only the condominium unit, not the whole condominium or, building, which would be a commercial insurance. And I'm sorry if she could. Call our office or get a hold of the California Earthquake Authority. I'd connect her with someone who can answer your question. I apologize.
All right, Erin. Thanks for your call. We've had a number of people who've asked about condo owners or renters policy. So let's take condos first of all. The earthquake insurance there would need to be purchased by the condo owners association, right?
You really need two things in unison to be really well prepared. The condominium association needs to make a decision to insure the whole building or the whole complex, the whole common area. That would be purchased through commercial insurance markets, and there is coverage out there. I'm told it's not inexpensive, but one can obtain it. But an association can get a broker and go find coverage for the entire building. But then the condominium unit itself, where the person lives, from the walls in, that's on the unit owner. And for that, you can buy a condominium unit insurance policy from us, from the California Earthquake Authority. Go to the website, click on condominium coverage, and you can see the options that are available to you there. You can cover basically the things that you own, the appliances and the things you own that are inside that unit. Plus, an important feature of our coverage is if there's a big earthquake, the individual condo owners might get an assessment from the association if they got to come up with some more money and everybody got to pony up in order to fix the common areas. You can that assessment can be covered in the condominium coverage that a condo unit owner can buy. Get that loss assessment coverage to guard against the risk of getting hit by a.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, I assumed it wouldn't be that attractive because any extensive damage to interior walls of a condo unit, if it's really extensive, then you've got a problem as to whether the building's habitable and whether the owner's association has insurance. And contents, you know, a person could self-insure for that. But if the assessment is a big deal, I didn't realize that it covers, you know, taking a deductible into account, that assessment for the condo owner. That's good to know. We'll continue our conversation with Glenn Pomeroy, CEO of the California Earthquake Authority. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Next hour on Air Talk, a bill in Sacramento which would significantly increase the financial incentives for buying an electric car. Question is, would it be enough money to make electric vehicles more attractive? Right now, there are only about 550,000 all-electric or hydrogen cell vehicles on California roads. That's way below what the state had set as its target for the number of electric vehicles by now. We'll talk about whether the increased financial incentive will be enough to get car buyers to purchase new electric vehicles. Right now, purchasing earthquake insurance, the question. The CEO of the California Earthquake Authority, Glenn Pomeroy, with us. Glenn, I want to ask you about for renters, earthquake insurance, what does it cover?
So glad you asked, because it's so cheap. Renters insurance will cover the things you own that are in the apartment that you rent or the house that you rent. The structure itself is on the landlord because you don't own it. They do, and it's up to them to fix it and to ensure that they have the ability to fix it. But what you as a renter can do is buy a renter's insurance policy. Again, you need an underlying renter's policy for other things like fire and burglary and so forth. But once you have that renter's policy in place, you can purchase a companion renter's insurance policy to cover you just for earthquake for like about $100 a year. Or it depends on how much coverage you want, but it's in that ballpark, $100, $150 a year, which also will cover you for if you can't live in that apartment for a while and you got to live elsewhere while the landlord's getting things fixed up, that you'll have additional living expense coverage to take care of you. So we have so many renters in California, and so few of them have any kind of renter's insurance at all. We're really encouraging across the board, get a renter's insurance policy and then pick up a renter's earthquake insurance policy. It is not very expensive. I had a daughter when she was in college, lived in a little apartment in a house that was just destroyed by fire. I was amazed at how much stuff my college daughter had accumulated, and we had a little renter's insurance policy, and it was really helpful to get her back on her feet. Anyway, it's a good idea for renters to get insured, and they should insure for earthquake too, and it's very affordable.
Tim in Manhattan Beach says, if my swimming pool breaks from an earthquake and it floods the neighbor below, is that covered? Am I responsible? Would that have to be under flood insurance? Glenn, do you have an answer for Tim?
I don't. I'm afraid getting beyond my pay grade on that one. That's not an earthquake insurance policy question. The lawyers would be involved, and
so earthquake would not cover it. So that would not be subject to it. I assume Tim would be liable if the pool's on his property and causes damage. But it's a good question as to whether that would have to be under flood insurance.
I doubt it'd be flood insurance, no. I think the lawyers would get involved and figure it out who's going to pay what on that one.
Straight liability, maybe. All right. Jackie in Silver Lake, good to have you with us.
Good morning, and thank you for taking the call. On the question of retrofitting, for homes that are built on a hillside and not a level foundation, is retrofitting possible, and to what degree of slope is it possible?
Glenn?
Hillside. It gets more difficult on hillside. There's a simple plan set that's available for homes that are on a level feel and a level slope, even for homes on a raised foundation or sit on top of a cripple wall. If the ground's fairly level, there's a fairly simple fix for that. You go in and put in some braces and bolts, and you don't need to get an engineer involved. And actually, if you do it, we can lower your premium by up to 25%. We give you a mitigation discount on your insurance policy. Now, for the home on the hillside, it gets more complicated. You need to get an engineer involved, but absolutely, an older home, let's say built prior to 1980. You absolutely should take a look at it. It's going to cost you more because there needs to be an engineered solution. but it's a more vulnerable home sitting on a hillside. Built prior to 1980, before building codes got strengthened, especially homes built prior to World War II, pre-1940, they were just built at a time when the construction standards weren't up to snuff, and many of these properties are pretty vulnerable.
I have a home that was built shortly after the war, and mine is retrofitted. It's a hillside home, and so it's bolted to the concrete foundation. It's on a pretty steep slope, Jackie, so I know that it is possible, and probably your neighbors in Silver Lake, I would guess that many of those homes have been retrofitted. Thanks very much. Let's take another call. This is from Marvin in Marina Del Rey. Your question.
Hi, we have California earthquake insurance and homeowners insurance. We have behind our main home a small auxiliary building that's included in our homeowners insurance coverage, but when I read the fine print on the California earthquake insurance, it doesn't appear to be covered. Is there any way to add to our California earthquake insurance the coverage for our small separate building?
I hear the question, and we'll take it under advisement. Our policy right now does not cover auxiliary buildings or swimming pools or fences around the property. We're really set up to help people get back into their home and get on with their lives. Now that we've been around for 22 years, we got our financial legs under us. We are beginning to think about, okay, what other things can we add on, or what other options can we at least offer to folks that they could add on? And so we are thinking about that auxiliary building question and swimming pools. I'll tell you, the events of last week have sort of put other considerations on hold. We have been going nonstop since Ridgecrest, and it's been a fascinating experience. We insure a couple thousand homes up there. And so we've got folks going 24/7 trying to figure out what the situation is there.
I'll bet. And thank you for taking all this time, Glenn. I'm sure it's just been crazy. So would a separate garage then not be covered? Is that considered a separate structure?
A separate garage is not covered.
Not covered. Okay.
Yes, garage is not covered.
All right. So you might have to leave your car out for a while. Marvin, appreciate your call. Let me quickly ask another question or two here. Matthew in Rancho Cucamonga says his insurance company says all new earthquake policies are frozen because of the recent earthquakes. He's insured homeowners with USAA. Glenn, clearly that's not true for the state program.
Not true at all, but we get that question, so I'm glad you asked it. Here's the situation. Anybody can buy a CA policy today. If they happen to live in Ridgecrest, there is a period of time that began the morning of July 4th, a 15-day period of time that began that morning, for which the policy they buy today won't cover aftershocks or earthquake related to the event that's still ongoing. And that's the old adage, you can't insure a burning building. And basically, it's felt like there's the event up there is still ongoing. When we develop our policy, said, okay, yeah, but there's got to be, you got to, got to cut off at some point so people can, you know, get a policy and get started. So our policy says for a 15-day period of time from the moment they have that first event,
okay,
a policy, but it's not going to start until that period of time runs. And that period didn't start again the next day when there was a 7.1. The 15-day period started.
Okay.
Or July 5th, but it was July 4th. But that only covers, that only applies to people up there.
So he's in Rancho Cucamonga, so that wouldn't apply to him. Glenn, thank you so much again, and I hope we can talk with you again just a few months down the road after things stop shaking so much in the Ridgecrest area. Appreciate it. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
Glenn Pomeroy, CEO of the California Earthquake Authority. My apologies. We didn't have time to take even more calls, but on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org, we've got a link to the website for the California Earthquake Authority with all kinds of in-depth answers to questions about earthquake insurance. You're listening to AirTalk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll be back, tell you about the second hour momentarily. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, we take a look at Aziz Ansari's return to stand-up comedy. His Netflix special is streaming, and he addresses the controversy over a date gone wrong that was written about by his former date just about a year and a half ago. He laid low after the publication of it. But the question is, has it had an effect on how Americans date? The gist of the essay, the young woman said that Ansari had not picked up on her cues that she was not interested in having sex with him at the date that was at his apartment. We're going to talk about whether there's been a lasting effect on dating or people's expectations in dating situations as a result of that piece. But we turn our attention right now to electric vehicles in California. There are about 550,000 all electric or hydrogen fuel cell cars that are on the road in California. That's well short of the goals the state has for getting Californians out of their gasoline-powered vehicles into all-electric ones. Well, to try to juice sales, Assemblymember Phil Ting of San Francisco has introduced a bill that would dramatically increase the subsidies for those buying all-electric vehicles. Assemblyman Ting, it's good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me, Larry. It's great to be back.
So it looks like the potential here, and I know this would have to be ironed out in full if it passes, but the potential is to triple the subsidy. Is that right?
It's one option. And the reason that we're taking a look at that option is the federal tax credit for Tesla and General Motors is going away. So people have been relying on a $10,000 subsidy, $7,500 coming from the federal tax credit, $2,500 coming from the state. So when you're reducing three-quarters of that rebate away for the two most popular cars, that's the Tesla Model 3, the Chevy Bolt, we have concerns that those cars are going to stop selling.
And without the federal subsidy, it sounds like the max under your bill would still be $7,500. So it would actually be, in totality, less of a rebate.
It would still be less, but I think it makes sense because they are fairly price competitive right now with a $7,500 rebate, and we anticipate as those cars become more popular, their prices would hopefully come down.
Well, don't the manufacturers, at least General Motors, don't they sell that car at a loss to try and meet the mandate for electric vehicles?
Right. Many of the manufacturers sell electric vehicles at a loss, which is very similar to what happens when you have early adoption technology. When you're trying to get technology up to speed, you can't quite do the volume it takes to make the kind of profit you need. And so that's traditionally why the state has been supportive of creating this rebate and really assisting in creating this incentive to encourage people to buy that kind of car.
So what has the state's research indicated about the barriers to purchasing all electric vehicles? Is it largely the cost of the vehicle? Is it the comparative lack of infrastructure for charging? Is it about the range?
The two major reasons people buy electric cars right now are the rebate in California are the rebates and the carpool stickers. So those are two huge incentives. So we've created the sticker program to get you into the carpool lane for a couple years. That's a huge incentive for keeping people in clean cars or moving people to clean cars. We think restructuring this rebate, the challenge with the rebate program is it's $2,500 today and $2,500 tomorrow, so there's no real incentive to buy today. If I can get the same rebate tomorrow, what's moving me? The idea would be to move more back to the similar to the California Solar Initiative, which started at a certain level and declined over time. And that really is the idea of doing a new reformed rebate program, which would start higher, but eventually go to zero. Right now, this is like $2,500 in perpetuity, so it's less of an incentive program, almost more of an entitlement program.
Now, the bill directs the State Air Resources Board to come up with the ongoing funding for the rebate. What are the potential sources?
No, the bill asks the State Resources Board to develop a plan to reform this program. So they would have to identify potential funding sources as well as the rebate amounts over time to get us to our goal. Our goal, you mentioned at the beginning of the program, we're at 550,000 clean cars. Our goal is to get to 5 million clean cars by 2030.
And you think that that goal is still reachable, or do you think, given the slow adoption of electric, that that's probably not going to be hit?
It actually, the adoption hasn't been slow. It actually has been very logarithmic. And so if you look at a chart, I think there are those of us like myself who are more impatient. We'd like everyone to move tomorrow. But if you actually look at a chart of adoption, it's actually moving quite fast.
All right. We're talking with State Assembly Member Phil Ting of San Francisco. The Democratic member of the state legislature has introduced a bill that would increase the state rebate for purchasing full battery all-electric vehicles from the current flat $2,500 up to $7,500, with an overtime reduction in the rebate as an idea of spurring people to sooner rather than later purchasing all-electric vehicles. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts. I mean, is this something that would prompt you perhaps to make that purchase of an all-electric vehicle that you wouldn't otherwise? Or what are the impediments potentially to you getting an all-electric vehicle? Is the range the factor? Is it the infrastructure for recharging the battery? What is it? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Assemblyman Ting, is there anything in here about making a more robust charging infrastructure?
We got that bill passed and signed last year. So the Energy Commission's charged with designing a more robust charging infrastructure. You're absolutely right. That's part of the plan. Now, again, most people who have electric vehicles, they charge at work or at home. And just about everybody I know has electricity at their home. So again, they just got to figure out how to be able to plug their car into their outlet to get the electricity.
All right. Also with us is James Moore, professor of engineering and public policy at the University of Southern California. Professor, good to have you with us. How much do you think this size of a rebate, the maximum of $7,500, will affect purchases?
Well, given that it's replacing effectively a federal tax incentive, I don't think it would have a large net effect. If I understand the Assemblyman correctly, and I think he's been very clear, he's trying to maintain an incentive that is already in place and has directed the Air Resources Board to find a way to plan a fund to do that. I think, in general, the idea of using pricing to promote or discourage behaviors that we don't think are in the public interest is a good idea and a reasonably sophisticated thing to do. The basic approach makes sense to me. I think there are other ways I would try to apply those tools in this case, but I understand what the legislation is intended to do. And having read it, I've got to say I've read much, much worse legislation.
Well, a backhanded compliment. What do you think is another way of incentivizing purchase of electric vehicles?
Well, we want to move away from, I think it's widely accepted, we want to move away from fossil fuels because of, there are many reasons, all the indirect costs of burning fossil fuels and what it does to the environment. And if I get on the freeway at rush hour, I slow other people up and I pollute the air, and those costs are real, but I ignore them because I don't pay them. So I take the trip if the benefits I experience are bigger than the costs I pay. So rather than picking winners and losers in an industrial policy sort of context, I think I would focus instead on internalizing the full cost of choosing to burn fossil fuels. And that step would make alternatives like electric vehicles far more competitive. It has less of an information burden because it leaves more decision-making with the consumer. All the consumer has to do is behave the way consumers are supposed to, respond to costs in the marketplace. And then ideally, we should make sure those costs are set competitively, and that makes them indices of scarcity. And all of that gives us the market efficiencies that we want.
Assemblyman Ting, the challenge, I would think, in having drivers of gasoline cars pay the full cost of that is how that would affect lower-income Californians and also just the political unpalatability of raising those costs for driving a conventional car.
Well, no, you're right, Larry, but I also agree with Professor Moore. In fact, the legislature over during my tenure over the last 6 years has moved exactly in the direction that Professor Moore talked about. We raised the gas taxes because there needed to be an honest payment of fees to fix our roads and to really help pay for more public transit. So we did that. We raised the gas taxes so that we could get more money to pave roads and to do public transit. We charge gas companies for pollution, and they pay into a greenhouse gas reduction fund. They sell credits. That money goes into a greenhouse gas reduction fund. So I totally agree with what Professor Moore's talking about. And so we're doing that in California. And that is actually, that money is how we're paying for the clean vehicle rebate program, because that money has to go to pay for different programs that reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. The big challenge with transportation is the largest sector of greenhouse gas emissions. It's 40%. And the challenge is 80% of that 40% is passenger vehicles, from the cars that I drive, Professor Moore drives, from the car that you drive, Larry. And we have to, rather than be able to make macro policy, we decided to try to change individual behavior through incentives, and that takes a while. It'd be like asking everybody to change the kind of coffee they drink. If you created incentives for people to change coffee, that would still take a while, even if you could set up a competitive pricing model.
We're talking with State Assembly Member Phil Ting, the Democratic member of the legislature from San Francisco. We're talking about his bill that he introduced, which would have a maximum rebate $7,500 per purchase of electric vehicle, up to the State Air Resources Board to come up with the plan for both funding and for stair-stepping that rebate to purchasers of all electric vehicles. Also with us is Associate Professor of Economics at UC Davis, David Rapson. He co-directs the Davis Energy Economics Program, and he's studied incentives for electric vehicles. Professor Rapson, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So what have you found about the cost of the rebate programs versus the incentive to purchase?
Well, one of the things that that we've shown in some of the research and that others have shown is that these rebates actually work. I think the idea is quite simple. You know, if you pay people enough, they'll buy, you know, whatever it is you want them to buy. And right now, the incentives for electric vehicles are very large, both at the federal level and at the state level. And so what we've found is that, yes, when you offer these incentives, people are going to buy electric vehicles. And we think that this has been a substantial contributor to the amount of EVs that are on the road in California today.
And does your research look at all about the sources for the subsidies, or just how much bang for the subsidy that the state is getting?
Well, yeah, there are a couple different sources of funds for the subsidies. I think the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund was mentioned earlier, and actually a colleague of mine, Eric Mueliger at UC Davis, and I studied the effect of one of those programs. So not only are these effective in the sense that they're achieving their goal, but they're also extremely expensive. And so one of the things that that we are thinking about today is, you know, California set these really ambitious goals to reach certain numbers of EVs on the road by 2025 and 2030. And by our estimates, achieving those goals is going to be very expensive. And you know, depending on what happens with the federal subsidies, which may go away or they may stay, the bill for California taxpayers could be upwards of $10 to $15 billion over the next 6 or 7 years.
Wow.
Which is a significant chunk of change.
Wow. Hillary and Cheviot Hill said, "This is my third leased electric vehicle, and I love it. The rebate was the incentive for me. What they don't tell you is you only get the rebate twice in your lifetime, which I find out after I leased my third vehicle." I think that's an important detail. Assemblyman Ting, would there be a lifetime limit on this rebate?
We haven't opined on that. At this point, we would really let the Air Board decide that. But as you can imagine, as more and more people move into EVs, we probably would either shrink the rebate and the incentive or make it, frankly, more selective. The idea is to get people out of gas cars into clean cars, not to have people keep trading in their clean cars over three-year periods.
We'll continue our conversation with Assemblyman Phil Ting, with Jim Moore, USC Professor of Engineering and Public Policy, and David Rapson of UC Davis, where he co-directs the Davis Energy Economics Program. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. My question for you is, would a $7,500 incentive be a difference maker for you in buying an all-electric car? We'll be back in 1 minute. Joel Grey, the actor and now stage director, is Terry Gross's guest coming up on Fresh Air here on 89.3 KPCC, having interviewed Joel Grey in the past. Just wonderful conversationalist, delightful guy. I know you're going to enjoy the conversation. That's with Terry Gross coming up at noon right after Air Talk here on KPCC. Right now, we're talking about a Sacramento bill which would increase the state subsidy for purchasing an all-electric vehicle. It would reach up to $7,500. The idea in Democratic Assemblyman Phil Ting's bill is that it would be stair-stepped to give an earlier incentive for the higher amount. Over time, the incentive would decrease to try and jumpstart purchases of all-electric vehicles. They currently number about 550,000 in the state of California and need to go up considerably to meet the state's fossil fuel reduction goals. Steve in Tarzana, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks, Larry. What about plug-in hybrids like the Toyota Prius Prime or the Honda Clarity? I drive around the valley 25, 30 miles a day. I'd never have to use gas unless I want to go on a longer trip.
What about— All right. Assemblyman Ting, are the plug-in hybrids covered?
So right now, hydrogen fuel cell cars are in the bill. And as of now, the current program does allow for plug-in hybrids up to a mile range of 25 miles. Now, I think personally that range should really be significantly increased for people who are really thinking about the environment. You know, you should really be in a car with at least 50 to 80 miles of range, and now you have a lot of options in that area.
Steve, appreciate the call. Janine in Tustin, welcome.
Hi. I'm very pro electric vehicles. But what I feel is that I wouldn't want to purchase one right now, no matter how much the incentive is, because the car I currently have, I don't need to replace it yet. So many people might not be buying one right now because the gas-burning car that they have currently works.
And that's a huge issue. Cars are so reliable and last so much longer now. And that's fueled the used car market as well, because there's so many used cars in good shape with still long life ahead of them. So that's a very important point you raised, Janine.
But I have one other question.
Yeah.
And I want an electric car, but my concern is that people have said, or I've heard, and I don't know if it's true, that the batteries, I have to replace them in like 5 years or so many years, and that it's in, quite a bit of money to replace the batteries.
Jim Moore, do you want to take that on?
Battery technology is constantly improving. We've got many incentives to shift from liquid batteries and liquid ion lithium batteries to solid state batteries. That shift will come. Those batteries will become more reliable. The caller is making exactly the kind of decision a consumer should make. She's making a decision at the margin. If I account for the sequence of costs that I'm going to bear, I want to understand them, and I want to know what to expect, and I want to then decide what's in my interest and do it. So I think we help ourselves if we can do away with as many hidden costs as possible. But technology is on the case in this case, and I know that EVTOL providers and Uber Air and a number of different technology initiatives really see a lot of merit in shifting to solid-state batteries. I think it'll open business possibilities for them, And so we'll see that change, and that particular constraint will be relaxed.
Chevy Bolt, I think, touts its range is 238 miles to give you an idea. So, you know, if you're looking at driving from L.A. to the Bay Area or L.A. to Sacramento, you wouldn't be able to make it, of course, without a charge. Assemblyman Ting, you drive a Chevy Bolt, is that right?
Yeah, I drive a Chevy Bolt, and I was just going to say for your caller, I've had my car over 2 years. I have more than 50,000 miles on my car, and I haven't noticed any battery degradation or any reduction in my charge. The other part, going back to Professor Moore's comment, hidden costs, what people don't always think of in terms of cost for their cars is the maintenance cost. Electric vehicles basically have zero maintenance. I've had my car for 2 years. I've taken it into the dealership twice, both free services, and the only thing they've been doing is to rotate the tires. Well, the one thing I had to do was replace my tires because I've driven it over 35,000 miles. But separate from that, I've had no maintenance costs with my car.
Well, and you're fortunate because your district's within the range of your car from Sacramento, so that worked out well.
Well, right. And the people, my colleagues from L.A., they don't drive from L.A. They fly.
They all fly, yeah. Those Southwest shuttles. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Eric in Palos Verdes, you're on Air Talk.
Yes, hi. I'm a former gasoline blender, and I think electric cars are great, but I don't think it's productive for the public health. To do this, the state has to tackle the issue of the huge multitude of large and small diesel vehicles, the large trucks and the pickup trucks. They're all over, and they spew out choking, annoying, and dangerous particulate emissions, and many of those engines are very, very big, especially in the large semi-tractor trailers, meaning they put out more. And they can go for millions of miles. This is the biggest problem that I see that we should be addressing first.
Assemblyman, you want to respond to the diesel truck question?
Absolutely. There is separate funding to replace light and heavy duty vehicle trucks like those diesel trucks in the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. This bill would not change that priority. But again, as I mentioned, 80% of our greenhouse gas emissions within transportation comes from passenger vehicles, cars that you and I are driving every single day. So again, while we are focusing on these trucks, there's a fallacy in people's minds saying that that's the main cause of greenhouse gas emissions. It's not. I think people oftentimes they need to look in the mirror about what they're driving every day and how they're creating the problem.
Eric, appreciate your call. Matthew in Pasadena, I understand you're a Tesla driver. Interested to hear, you know, what motivated you to make the purchase?
Yes, I was motivated by both the decal and the rebate. But recently I ran into some frustrations because of the decals that came when I purchased the car in 2016 are the white decals, which no longer are valid in the carpool lane. And I was surprised to learn that I was unable to upgrade those to the current decals. I actually just got a second Tesla and learned that I was unable to qualify for the rebate as my income was beyond that threshold. When I think that's a shame in that there are, you know, potentially a lot of customers out there that are not going to be able to take advantage of the rebate. Even though they may have a higher income, it still is an incentive.
Assemblyman Ting?
Again, as the Professor Rabson talked about at UC Davis, I mean, we have limited amount of funds, and we definitely wanted to ensure that the money went to folks that really couldn't afford the car to begin with, which is why income caps were put in. I believe the income cap right now is $150,000. And again, the carpool decals are temporary. They're not permanent. That's what happened. I bought a Toyota Prius. When I first bought my Toyota Prius in 2005, I had stickers. Over time, those stickers became invalid because there was new technology that went with it. So again, these are incentives. They're not seen as permanent benefits. We would have clogged carpool lanes if we allowed a permanent benefit to everybody who had an electric car. So unfortunately, that's not what we can do. But we are trying to, again, incentivize behavior. And we believe that by doing both the decal and both the rebate and the decal, that that will help move people into clean cars.
Matthew, appreciate the call. Now, Ray in Irvine called and sees this from the opposite perspective. He says that all electric vehicles should not be, they shouldn't all be subsidized. People who can afford a Tesla, Ray says, they don't need a study. The fund should be provided to people to buy entry-level EVs instead. That's Ray in Irvine. Let's talk next with Barry in Palm Springs. Welcome.
Hi. The question I had, I'm all for the gas tax helping rebuild roads to improve our infrastructure, but the EVs aren't paying gas tax that I'm aware of, and is there some other way of taxing them on, they are using the roads, they're just electric versus gas.
Professor Rapson, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, certainly that's an issue, that the more EVs on the road, the less gas tax is going to be collected, and that becomes a funding issue for highway maintenance and such things. I know that there's been talk about imposing a fee on electric vehicles that would make up for that, and that seems sensible, but of course that's going to act in the opposite direction of the incentives that we're discussing today. So, you know, it also reminds me that there's another element of this that hasn't been discussed yet, which is electricity prices. And, you know, California has the most expensive electricity prices in the country. And, you know, here we are trying to incentivize people to move towards that technology. And so I think the alignment of all of these policies really needs to be thought about in a holistic way.
Yeah, Gary in Monrovia wanted to bring up this point. Said, what about the electricity being produced in order to charge electric cars? Professor Rapson mentioning the cost of that. But Gary says, doesn't that also have a carbon footprint? Jim Moore of USC?
It does. We have to think about the cost of each ton of greenhouse gases that we remove. And that means we've got to understand how power is generated. California, in particular, has been aggressive in trying to move toward alternative sources of generating electricity, and that's one of the reasons that we pay as much as we do for electricity. We can expect to pay more, but yes, electricity doesn't grow on trees. You often wind up needing to burn fossil fuels somewhere else in order to make electricity available at your doorstep. I'd say that. You know, I'm cognizant of David's work, and I think it's very good work. One of the reasons I promote internalizing external costs is because it generates revenues. I think, you know, SB1 was good legislation. It does include a small fee for electric vehicles. It's a step forward, but it was so controversial because it drew our attention to the fact that we need an alternative mechanism for funding road supply, because right now everything really is predicated on gas taxes, and if we want to move away from burning fossil fuels, we're going to need an alternative funding mechanism. So that's why I suggest we focus on policies that generate funds that we can target for the purposes that we want. Certainly providing incentives will influence behavior because people are economic animals, but suppose this incentive worked quickly, the way we, in the best case, suppose we went from 500,000 electric vehicles to 5 million, and it cost us $7,500 a head to do that. Well, now we're talking about having spent in the neighborhood of $30 billion. The legislation that the Assemblyman's put together says that the Air Resources Board should only proceed if we can find a taxpayer revenue neutral way to do this. But even if we can, that's $30 billion the state is not spending on other purposes. So
all right. I appreciate it, Jim Moore, USC Professor of Engineering and Public Policy, David Rapson, Associate Professor of Economics, UC Davis, where he co-directs the Davis Energy Economics Program. And our thanks to Democratic Assemblymember Phil Ting of San Francisco, who's introduced the bill that would increase the state's rebate for purchasers of all electric cars up to as much as $7,500. Coming up on Air Talk, we'll take a look at the case of comedian actor Aziz Ansari. He's back with a Netflix special about a year and a half after an essay describing a very unpleasant date from a young woman's perspective. We'll talk about whether her essay had any effect on the ways in which people date. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going great. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. You might recall about a year and a half ago, a young woman who used the name Grace described a date that she thought went very wrong with actor-comedian Aziz Ansari. He invited her, according to her account, to go to his apartment. And once they were there and after wine was poured, she alleged that Ansari put moves on her to try and lead toward sexual activity. And she was upset that he hadn't picked up on her cues, that she was not interested in sex, and that she felt pressured by him in his apartment. Now, that essay created a whole host of responses. It raised the question of what people's expectations are from dating, what sorts of cues people are expected to pick up on, what are the expectations for someone to verbally say if they are or are not comfortable with sexual activity. Well, Ansari exited the public scene for months and is back now with a Netflix comedy special in which he starts off acknowledging the allegations of the young woman against him.
You know, I haven't said much about that whole thing, but I've talked about it on this tour because you're here and it means a lot to me. And I'm sure there's some of you that are curious how I feel about that whole situation. And it's a tricky thing for me to answer, because I felt so many things in the last year or so. There's times I felt scared. There's times I felt humiliated. There's times I felt embarrassed. And ultimately, I just felt terrible that this person felt this way. And after a year or so, I just hope it was a step forward. And it moved things forward for me. It made me think about a lot. I hope I become a better person. And I always think about a conversation I had with one of my friends where he was like, you know what, man? That whole thing made me think about every date I've ever been on. And I thought, wow, well, that's pretty incredible. This made not just me, but other people be more thoughtful, then that's a good thing. And that's how I feel about it.
That's Aziz Ansari from his new Netflix streaming comedy special. So my question for you isn't specifically about Ansari himself or about his career. I'm really interested in whether the account of that date, which set this all off with Ansari, whether that changed the way that you date, your expectations for what does or doesn't need to be said, the picking up of cues from someone who's reluctant to have sex. I'd like to hear what, if any, changes. Like Ansari's friend, his friend who said, wow, this made me think about every date I've ever been on. Has it changed the way that you date or the type of people you date? 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is the Washington Post relationship column writer and editor, Lisa Bonos, who's been writing about the Ansari case and other things related to dating today. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you've kind of followed this. And what's your sense from your readers and people you've spoken with? Do you think that the incident as recounted by the young woman has had an effect on people's expectations or way they communicate in dates?
For sure. I think for one part of it, a lot of singles saw themselves in that situation. They could relate to it. They'd been in situations where they'd felt pressured to get physical or had trouble speaking up, saying that they weren't comfortable with something or flat out leaving when maybe that's what they would have preferred to have done. And so I've spoken to a lot of singles who've said that they've been thinking back to old situations and gone into dating in a new light, maybe from men waiting for women to be more proactive to ask them out, or men thinking about the ways that they might be pressuring women, and women thinking about their own lives and what they've done in the past as well, because you know, this isn't just men being one way and women being another way. It can go anyway.
Well, and so much was raised about the, you know, the issue is if someone is in a position of authority or a you know, successful person. And I wonder if it's made people more reluctant to date where there's a differential like that, because if you're going out with someone and you don't feel that you're empowered to say no or to back them off, maybe people are thinking about, you know, well, maybe I don't want to go out with that person. Conversely, if it's someone who is in the more powerful position, maybe they're more skittish about going out with someone who they might feel would, you know, accuse them of using that position.
Yeah, I think we've definitely seen that in the workplace as far as intra-workplace relationships, just because the Me Too era has made people think about that so much. I mean, it's harder to translate that to real life. You know, are you not going to go out with a comedian or someone who's a celebrity because they might pressure you? It's hard to think about what might happen before you get to that situation, right?
All right, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You're single, you date. Has that account of that night at Aziz Ansari's place changed the way you date? Has it made you think differently about your dating habits? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Yvonne writes on the page, he didn't pick up on her cues, then she needed to say no thank you and be gone. We as women all know that when any guy invites us to go inside their humble abode, that means he's making a move and is inviting us to have sex. That's Yvonne from Tustin writing on the Air Talk page, 866-893-KPECC. Pippi echoing that, saying, well, if she wasn't interested in this guy in that way, why on earth would she accept an invitation to his home? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Astro Goth writes on the page, the one reason I wouldn't want to be a teen again is the current dating scene. The sexes seem to hate each other. 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Lisa, what are some of the generational differences that you've seen with dating expectations?
Yeah, well, there's many. I mean, you think about how sex education has changed a lot in the past decades. It also varies by state, some and school district. Not some people have widely different ranges of how much education they got, and people of all different ages are dating each other in the pool. Right? You can have a 22-year-old going out with a 40-year-old who are raised in different eras, watching different kinds of movies and TVs that have wildly different messages, and just the sex education and the rape prevention that's been happening on college campuses has really ramped up a lot in the past decade or so.
Yeah, and is there an expectation? You know, I haven't been singing a long time, but is there an expectation now that if someone is going to initiate sex, that that is explicitly verbal, that someone really can't physically move towards someone in a sexual way without clearing that verbally? Is that the new expectation?
The ideal is that it's spoken about first. Does that happen all the time in practice? Not necessarily. But there are many instances within an interaction where a person could get consent and talk about, are you okay with this? Is this okay? Or even vocalize the things they would like to do and see how someone responds to that. It's kind of a way of putting desire out there and seeing what kind of response you get can be another way of doing it.
Well, I'd love to hear from listeners. Do you think that is desirable? Is that the ideal of dating, that if one of the parties is interested in being sexual in some way, that that be verbalized? Is that essential? Is that better in a dating relationship? Or is there an advantage with someone subtly making some sort of a sexual gesture and the other person accepting or saying no to that? 866-893-KPECC. What do you see as the best scenario for a dating relationship when it comes to sex? We'll be back in 1 minute. Since the essay in which a young woman claimed that Aziz Ansari was insensitive in how he dealt with her on a date that ended at his apartment, my question is, has that changed the way you date? If you're a single person who dates, is that something that raised red flags for you, maybe made you more sensitive in how you conduct yourself on a date? Did it make you more hesitant about inviting someone to your place or going out on a date? And do you think it's an ideal that when you're out with someone, that any sort of move towards a sexual gesture of some kind, that that needs to be explicitly verbal, that it can't be gestural, that it can't be in some sort of a subtle way towards sexual activity, that it absolutely needs to be verbally explicit, that you get the okay of the other person before you make a physical gesture of some kind? 866-893-KPECC. Susan in Santa Monica, what do you think is the ideal?
First of all, I disagree with the comments that if I get invited into a man's apartment, that means he's inviting me in for sex. That is ludicrous, in my opinion.
Okay. All right.
Number two, I have to become more sensitive to myself, meaning if I begin to kiss a man in his apartment, again, that doesn't mean that I'm telling him we're going to have sex. It means that I want to kiss. But if he starts to do something else, or if something else is being done that's making me uncomfortable, I need to be sensitive to myself and speak up. If he doesn't respect me speaking up or stop, I need to get my purse and leave.
Mm-hmm. Susan, at what point, if any, would you want it to be a verbal ask before the person you're with goes beyond kissing and maybe, you know, wants to touch you in a sexual way or in some way is leading, you know, into a sexual act? What do you want that to be explicitly verbal? And if so, when?
Personally, no, thank you. I don't want to be asked. I think it should become verbal. If I begin to like push somebody's hand away, then he might say, "Oh, do you want me to stop?" Like, that would be appropriate. And then I could say, "Yeah, that's what I meant when I pushed your hand away." But like, before somebody kisses me, I don't want him to say, "Is it okay if I kiss you?"
All right. Susan, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jessica tweets at AirTalk, "My takeaway is it's really important to teach our girls when we're raising them that it's okay to say no unapologetically." That's Jessica tweeting at AirTalk. Let's talk next with O in the Melrose area. O, you're on AirTalk.
Hi, Larry. Long-time listener, first-time caller. How you doing?
Great. Doing well. Go right ahead.
I wanted to just say that, you know, as a man's perspective, like, we need to pick up on what the ladies, if we're on a date or on a relationship, we are the ones responsible to pick up on those hints and the notes that if a lady doesn't want us, then we need to stop it right there. Even if we have a shred of doubt in our mind that what we're doing is wrong, we need to stop. And we need to just, you know, part ways to don't make the lady uncomfortable, because it's very ungentlemanly-like. And we know, and a lot of times, especially nowadays, kids are very desensitized with the social media and with, like, all these new dating apps and whatnot. Like, everybody's just looking to get laid or have sex or whatnot. And, you know, like, the old school ways have gone away. Like, for me personally, if I'm on a date, I would at least minimum would want to go out 4 or 5 times just to get the
Oh, you're breaking up, but I appreciate your call. 866-893-KPECC. Steve in Rancho Cucamonga says people can pick up cues in different ways, but I don't think a man should engage in any type of sexual activity unless the cues are 100% clear. And that's a good point because, you know, sometimes people give inconsistent cues because when it comes to sex, people can be dual-minded. They can be attracted to the idea of it, but also have doubts and second thoughts. You know, we as humans don't necessarily give consistent and clear messages when it comes to what we want sexually. Al in Pomona, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, everyone. My comment was that someone had talked about girls and, you know, telling the girls, raising the girls. In my opinion, I had read the Aziz Ansari article and followed it. If you're an adult, you know, man or woman, it's kind of, the onus is on you to say, this is the line, please respect it. And I think, you know, just because someone is, in my opinion, that person's not ready to date if they're not ready to tell that other party what they're comfortable or not comfortable with. And plus, part of the magic of romance is that spontaneity. If you're having to sign a consent form every step of the way, or if there's a lot of doubt towards the signals, you know, that are being sent out by the other person, it can kind of kill the mood, if that makes sense.
Yeah, Al, I appreciate it. You know, one of the other things I was struck by in the story that Grace told the first time I read it was that she sort of in her mind had Ansari. She sort of had an image of him and an expectation of who he was, how he would be on a date. She had sort of projected him out from his public persona. And she described sort of part of being frozen was that she just hadn't anticipated that he would, in her mind, behave in a way differently than she anticipated stage persona Ansari being, which is kind of interesting thought. Daisy in Hollywood, you're on Air Talk. Real quickly, your observation.
Yeah, I just want to say that consent can be rescinded at any point in an interaction between adults. You may go to someone's apartment with the intent on having sex with them, and at any point in the evening, if you have changed your mind, that is your right to do so. And sometimes, as a woman, I can say from my own experience, and as a small woman, I have felt rationally or irrationally in danger, which has made it harder for me to explicitly say no for fear that I might be punished. And I have a 6-year-old son, and I teach him every day to ask if it's okay to touch somebody and to read body language. And if my 6-year-old son can learn that, then I think adult people can learn that as well.
Daisy, appreciate your call. That's Daisy in Hollywood. My thanks as well to Washington Post relationship column writer and editor Lisa Bonos for joining us. She's been writing about Aziz Ansari, his Netflix comedy special, Comeback, in the wake of the essay that was given by Grace about her dating experience with Aziz Ansari. Have a wonderful afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. She talks with the wonderful Joel Gray. Make sure you stay tuned for that. And I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk on KPCC.